Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilek, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 196, being recorded on the 20th of September, 2017, with special guest Sasha Rosenbaum. I'm Sujit, and on Skype with me, I have Kale, Evan, and our special guests. And of course, as usual, let's get started with some of the recent updates in the Azure space. And what's cooking this week, guys?
I'll go ahead and jump in with Terraform. So there's a our listeners might recognize the name from the HashiCorp partner that we've had on here a few times on the podcast. There's a blog post out here by Corey Sanders from the compute team talking about, you know, the investment we have with Terraform in working with them, as well as some new things that were just announced, I think, yesterday. There's a Hashi conference, or HashiConf, I think it was called, where they basically announced some native support for the Azure Cloud Shell and a few different modules. I think there's eight modules as part of this registry, module registry, which essentially allows you to kind of work with load balancers, virtual machines, virtual scale sets, and whatnot in the Terraform context as you're kind of scripting those things out.
Yeah, and you know, we just had Chris Kent on like 3 weeks ago, I think, right, from HashiCorp. And I honestly wasn't aware that we were working so closely with them. So this came as a bit of a surprise when I caught up on this news. So it looks like I guess it's an advantage to work with them, right? Because you want them to people to deploy HashiCorp solutions on Azure. But I didn't realize you were working so close with them. I noticed some of the previous updates that were made to that also included things like the event grid and things like that, which we're going to talk about today. So that's a good update. What about you, Evan? What are you liking that?
So the planned maintenance, right, has been something that we've been talking about for a long time. And we, you know, those of you who've been on the platform for a long time, remember, like, maintenance was painful years ago, right? It was this, you know, this awful thing, a lot of cases driven by a lot of customer complaints. We've recently, you know, we've been really trying to improve this. We've done a bunch of things to speed up the maintenance. We actually made changes to the OS and the host level so that, you know, a lot of maintenance can happen without restarts. But there still is a class of things that need restarts. So we've recently rolled this out, and this is in preview now. You should see it in your portal. But you now have the ability, you'll be told when your maintenance window is coming, and you can either choose to do your maintenance ahead of time, at which point you won't be impacted. You kind of do it on your own schedule. And then if you choose not to take advantage of that, when the window comes around, we'll do the work for you at that point. So you'll get your reboot at that point. But that ability really to plan around that is huge, right? Because you don't want downtime that's unexpected.
Right.
It's much, much easier, much better to be able to say, hey, this, you know, Saturday night at, you know, Saturday morning at 10 a.m. is good for me for my business. So that's what I'm going to do my maintenance.
Yep. There's another one that, you know, this is a very common problem that most applications have to deal with, right? How to store a password or some sort of credential in your code. You obviously don't want to do that. So you say, okay, I'm going to store it in Key Vault, for example, which is our preferred way to store it. But it's a kind of a chicken and the egg problem, because to get to Key Vault, you need yet another set of credentials. Right? So that's always been something that's, you know, I'm sure a lot of people get irritated with it. I used to have to deal with that second credential just to get to the other credential that I really want. And so there's this new service facility called Managed Service Identity now, where Azure will automatically inject a certain credential into your service, your app service, or VM, or Azure Functions. Those are the three things that have that right now. And then in your code now, when you need the credential to get to Key Vault, for example, right? You don't have to store it anywhere. You call this local, there's a local endpoint that's exposed, and you just call that, and it'll give you back the token, and you can then present that token to Key Vault and get your secret, you know, whatever you store in Key Vault. And so the nice thing about the app knows nothing about any credential. There's no credential at all in the app. The app is just going to call this local endpoint, and if everything's been configured correct, that local endpoint would return to you a valid AD token, and then you could present that token to Key Vault or any other facility that needed an AD token for that matter. So I think that's something that's very useful.
I would say that, I mean, that's huge, right? If you're leveraging those services, I mean, that's massive.
Yeah.
Because you don't have to manage that anymore. I mean, it's just kind of in line.
Yeah, I mean, it's just I always felt like this was an odd problem to solve, and it's nothing related, nothing limited to Azure. Other cloud vendors also have to deal with this problem. It's just that Azure now makes it injects the credential for you. You know, you just have to select that option when you deploy the service, and so just this way, the application code contains absolutely no credentials, which I think is the correct way to go.
Yeah, I can't wait till there's some way, if we can solve the problem of some of the on-premises applications with the same problem, I will be super thrilled, because I was fighting with that myself this past week.
Yep. So what about this? Do you see this enhancements they made to the storage?
Yeah, I was at an internal event last week, and they were talking about this. Some of the storage team was there talking through this, but it was kind of interesting. So basically, there's a bunch of new features there for blob storage accounts. You can check it out in the blog post, but I think it's up to like a 10x increase in the storage account. So like
5 petabytes.
Yeah.
I'm having a hard time even imagine how many zeros are involved there, but...
So that's definitely welcome. I mean, there's workloads out there that are, I know specifically workloads that build terabyte files, like single files, and that's like, hard to scale with traditional, storage that we had before.
Yep. This is very nice. Well, there was another update that I was kind of looking at with regard to Service Stack, Azure Stack, sorry. So, Azure Stack is our kind of private data center version of Azure. The problem with that is that the administrator, which is typically running, working at the data center, has to manage the updates to Azure Stack, right? Because in the public version of Azure, Microsoft does that for you, but in the Azure Stack version, somebody else has to take that role. And so it's kind of been a little bit of a problem to deploy these updates, and now they've kind of made this really cool orchestration engine that you can download the updates onto the administrator can do that, and then at some appropriate time, be it in the middle of the night or early morning, they can automatically deploy these updates, and it's aware of the dependencies, so that it automatically will update all the dependent services as well. So that's something new in the Azure Stack world.
It sounds a lot like SUSE, WSUSE.
Yeah, and, kind of.
Yeah.
Yep. Exactly. But to all the resource providers, etc., can be updated that way. All right. What else? Anything else that I miss?
I got a blockchain update. So,
Come on.
No, it's actually not an update, but I'd received a lot of feedback, like from listeners, actually. We've been hearing that people want more blockchain on here, so just kind of spreading that around. We'll try to bring some more stuff on here. I'm going to bring some partners as well to talk about some of the solutions on there, just... if people don't want as much or want more or any other stuff, obviously the website's out there and people can reach out, but just start some feedback about that.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. And just in case people want to leave feedback, just send us a message on our Twitter account. That's the preferred way. I've been told our contact us page on the website is not really working. I've got to go and check it out, but use the Twitter handle to leave us a message. There was one more thing about Australia, right, Evan?
I would say that we added a couple more centers in Australia. Now, these are actually more of the that they use, because it's not quite It's called
sovereign cloud.
Yeah, they have this. They have the concept of unclassified and protected data, right? So this is kind of it's a sovereign data center, right? So this is, you know, meeting government type requirements, and in this case, it's for the Azure or for the Australian government, right? Meets their requirements for secure data, and so we've got these. You know, this is in partnership with an Australian firm, Canberra. But yeah, this is another couple data centers to handle some specialized workloads in Australia.
So this almost sounds like the Australian version of Azure Gov, right?
Yeah, it sounds really close. Yeah, I mean, and we've got the German data center, right, which has similar concepts. You know, we typically as a group, we call these sovereign, sovereign clouds because they're designed kind of for these government type scenarios across the world.
All the data is located locally. It's not nothing's outside of Australia.
Yep. And we've got restrictions on like who can help support it and what we can touch. Like I can't touch certain things in sovereign clouds. I have to look over somebody else's shoulder, you know, that kind of stuff. So yeah, all kinds of restrictions to help protect that data.
Cool. Well, thanks for all those updates, guys. Appreciate it putting in there. So let's, without further ado, let's get to our special guest, Sasha. Sasha, I'd appreciate if you could introduce yourself to our listeners and tell us what, you know, what you're passionate about in the Azure space, and we'll take it from there.
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, thank you guys for inviting me here. The podcast is absolutely awesome. So you're doing a great job here. I'm Sasha Rosenbaum. I'm an Azure TSP on a global black belt team. And I've been with Microsoft for about 2 years now. Before that, I was working for a Microsoft partner. So I've actually been working with Azure since like early days when everything it was is just cloud PaaS, cloud services. So I still remember that. And compared to today when we have like literally hundreds of different offers and services in there. And I just published a book on Azure serverless computing with .NET. And I guess that brings us to the podcast topic of today.
That's awesome. Yeah, I like that term, black belt, global black belt. That sounds so cool.
I need to get that in my title somewhere.
So, okay, maybe just spend a minute telling us what does it mean to be an Azure global black belt.
Yeah, so it the name is actually controversial, so we were wondering if it's going to be changed, but it wasn't this year at least. It kind of makes you feel like, you know, we're doing martial arts here and stuff, but I guess the idea, the team came from incubation, and so basically the idea is that we help people implement the new technologies, both things that we are rolling out, like the new products that come onto Azure, and also integration with other stuff, right? Because people are working with Kubernetes and things like that. We have to be folks supporting that effort. So we kind of aim to cover the newest technology that other folks have not had chance to ramp up on.
Awesome. I know I should say congratulations on the book. That's quite an achievement to write a book on serverless computing, or write a book on anything for that matter. But you know, you said earlier that you've been involved with Azure since early days. So can I give us a quick snapshot as to, you know, how you went from those early days to focusing on something like serverless computing?
Yeah, so it's actually very interesting because I think Azure was ahead of its time, right? Because when Microsoft released PaaS cloud services, I come from a developer background, so I thought this was the new and great thing, right? You can just go in and not worry about infrastructure and just deploy your application in minutes, and this is so awesome. And then we came into you know, client meetings, and the clients would be like, "Well, this is great, but what about my network firewall?" But I want to control the VMs. Where are the VMs? I don't have access to VMs. I want to be able to, you know, install the patches myself. So we kind of, I feel like as a company, we backtracked to that and we said, okay, maybe people are not ready to pass cloud services, right? And they want to have infrastructure as a service first. So basically, that's how it started. So we started rolling out new and new services in that sense, right? And I guess I became, because I was working with Azure at that point, I became sort of like, I ramped up more and more on infrastructure, even though my my background was in development. So I kind of walk this path between. I'm actually on the cloud infrastructure team right now. So it's an interesting thing to end up on if you're a developer in your former life. So, yeah. I think the world is really converging, right? Because we do infrastructure as code, and then at the same time, we do, like, you know, things like serverless compute, which is, like, all event-based and all is, like, everything is both infrastructure and dev right now, right? You're not talking about application context as much anymore, and you're not talking about managing servers for the sake of managing servers. Everything is integrated, and everything is about DevOps and kind of rolling out things in an automated way.
Yeah, this is Evan. I'm thrilled, Sasha, to hear you talk about, you know, kind of where in some ways it feels like we took a step back to IaaS. I mean, it made sense because that's what our customers ultimately wanted. But I think they, you know, because I've been doing, you know, SQL Azure since the early days, so kind of lived through all that as well. And I think you're absolutely right. Like we went too fast, and we really had to kind of give people the framework and help them understand kind of how to get there, because you're right. People wanted to be able to install their servers. They wanted to be able to touch the NIC and touch the OS. But I don't think it's because they really wanted to. I think that's just what they knew, right? It was enough of a leap of faith to go to this server, this VM that's not running somewhere that you don't have access to it, you know, kind of physically. But on top of that, taking away that extra level of control. And I think now, you know, and this probably is where it gets into the serverless computing that, you know, that it sounds like you're spending more and more time with. Right now we're coming back around to that, but we've kind of gotten smarter about it, and we figured out how to do it in a serverless fashion rather than having these, you know, VMs that were, I mean, we didn't even have containers back then, right? These were basically full Windows machines that were, you know, kind of locked down and you could get into, but you couldn't, nothing was persistent except your code. And now it's kind of coming back around, but in a smarter fashion.
And this is another interesting thing, right? Because back in the day, people used to talk a lot about vendor lock-in and, hey, we're not going with cloud because then we're dependent on you and stuff like that. And now we're talking about serverless. Now, I mean, I have to say, without functions, right, with functions runtime, you can actually run them anywhere, right? But people stop being afraid of this. People are okay going with, like, AWS Lambda or Azure Functions or whatever it is and be fully vested in a cloud provider because they know that this is where the world is going.
So, yeah, but I see what you're saying. But, okay, so if PaaS services was, you know, we were ahead of our time with PaaS services and people went back to IaaS, now they're almost like serverless computing is almost like a leap forward, right? You're really asking people to take another leap of faith now, just like we were expecting them to take to PaaS services back then. I feel like, you know, from going from IaaS all the way to serverless computing, it seems like a gigantic leap, no?
So, I guess what happened with serverless is that actually, AWS was the first, right, to release serverless compute with AWS Lambda, and it was extremely useful to actually control IaaS services, and it actually how it came to be, right? So it was a natural progression of, hey, I want to handle my VMs in an automated fashion, and here's the way you can run this script without managing infrastructure or application even for it, right? So we were actually asked to release this service as part of Azure, and I think we did a really good job because we kind of learned from, you know, people who have tried to do it before us, and we released it with some improvements. But yeah, it is a giant leap, though. An interesting thing about this is, so I've when I was first starting to, like, research the book, I've read in a bunch of places people were saying, hey, you can take your application logic here and you can replace it totally with, like, serverless compute. I mean, that is such an exaggeration because serverless.
No kidding. Yeah.
And I mean, maybe it makes sense to people who've never like developed a larger application. I'm not sure, but it just it's like when you have a hammer, everything is a nail. It's like people who say, hey, microservices are going to solve all our problems, or Docker containers are going to solve all our problems. Well, they can solve some problems, and that is if you approach them correctly, right? So if we're talking about serverless compute, functions are inherently, they're stateless. They're absolutely stateless. They're event-based, so they're supposed to be triggered and supposed to, like, they usually, it depends on the settings and implementations and whatnot, but usually they have a time execution limit as well, right? So there's many, many things that don't fit into functions. In terms of logic here, but then there's many things that are absolutely great for functions, because if we're talking about like all the data driven world and all the like billions of IoT devices or mobile devices and stuff like that posting updates every second, then like functions are an ideal platform to handle that and handle all the scaling and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that your autoscaling comment is key, right? Because that's one of the things that the serverless brings is you don't know or don't care anything about what the infrastructure underneath is doing to scale up or scale out. You don't even really know what it's doing, right? You just know that it's servicing your load, right? Versus some of the other solutions, you kind of have to – you don't necessarily have to manage the scale up and the scale down yourself, but you have to configure it. You have to be aware of it and the like, right? That's one of the key benefits of serverless, right?
It is truly, and the thing is, it is truly dynamic, right? Because you can go from like one instance to like on the back end, which again, you don't necessarily care about, but on the back end, you can go from one instance to like 1,000 and you don't even know about it, you don't care, and you don't like, you essentially truly pay as you go, pay for what you use, right? So this is an amazing, like if you're managing, say, I don't know, a Super Bowl commercial and you need to run a simple script every time somebody clicks a button, that is a great platform, right? And back in the day, you would have to manage like thousands of servers and standby just to support that load. And now you can do this with functions.
That reminds me of I used to talk about when I first used to talk to people about why cloud was useful, right? I used to exactly talk about a scenario like that. I talked about tax season, right? And you have these companies that we all file our taxes with. And I don't know how many servers they have sitting around, but 10 years ago they had physical servers sitting there, and then they would have hundreds or whatever during the 2 months of tax season here in the US, and then they'd sit the rest of the year. And then cloud comes along, and now it's, hey, they spin up the 100 instances they need for 2 months, and then they spin it back down to 2. Now, what you're saying is kind of with serverless, they can go to that next level, and they don't even have to care about servers. They just say, I want to be able to execute this chunk of code, figure out what it takes to run it at the scale and the frequency that I need it at any time. Like, I just don't have to worry about it. I just publish my code, and it gets run. When somebody calls it, it gets called. If the load goes up, Microsoft handles it. If the load goes down, Microsoft handles it for me. I don't have to care.
So you actually bring me to another good point, by the way, because so we keep calling this serverless, right? But I think that's not a super descriptive name for what we're doing, because if you think about it, every PaaS service is essentially serverless, right? When you deploy web apps, your app service, you don't care about servers, you don't provision infrastructure, you don't do patching. All of these things are still abstracted away from you. Now, when you go to functions, though, what happens is you abstract away the application as well. So you no longer care about your application stack. Like, usually when you, even for a small bit of code, you still have to deploy a full application, and you have to deploy like different things on the same application stack and stuff like that. With functions, you want to write something in Node.js and something else in C# and something else in Python, you're free to do that. And this can be a tiny snippet of code that just runs there in the serverless environment.
So Sasha, so give us a good, from a developer perspective, right, because that's your background, give us some good use cases that you've seen, that you may have worked on or have seen in your black belt work, as it relates to Azure Functions.
Yeah, so anything that basically needs a massive horizontal scale and that needs to scale up on demand. So something that processes events, for instance, let's say you upload images to blob storage, you can process that with functions. Or let's say you can process messages that get dropped into a service bus and stuff like that. Right? So anything that whenever you are experiencing big spikes in load, that come intermittently or come like a huge spike at a time, that is definitely a good use case for Azure Functions.
I see. And then what are some not so good use cases that you can think of?
Well, the not so good use case would be something long running, right? So if you need to perform a huge computation that is like compute heavy, even though it sounds like it's a good use case because, you know, in infinite scale and all that, Azure Functions are really not made for that. So in that case, you would go to high performance compute, you would go to Azure Batch. And you would provision this huge, massive VMs that can run for long computations for long periods of time.
So you're basically you would want to do that scale up somewhere, in essence, rather than kind of what you're talking about with the serverless stuff then.
You would do the scale up and scale out essentially, but functions usually, so again, in app service, functions don't have a time execution limit. In consumption though, in consumption plan where they scale truly dynamically, they have an execution time limit. So you definitely don't want to time out on that execution time. So that's one of the reasons. Another thing is like shared code. So let's say you had different clients with different like requests coming from say mobile and web and stuff like that. And your logic tier needs to handle like authentication or a certain type of like state. Then you don't want to do this with Azure Functions probably because the functions are truly stateless. So don't care. They're just a pass through for an event, right? So they will not maintain your authentication. They will not handle authentication. They can handle authentication. Actually, I'm gonna backtrack on that and say, if you wanted to like authenticate it against a function endpoint, as in your function is your endpoint, like you don't have a web client, but you're actually authenticating against the function, you can still do it. And we have built-in services the same way that App Service has with like Azure AD or like Twitter or whatever. And you can also do obviously API keys.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. So like on the state model, I mean, one way you can kind of get around it, I guess, is because they're fully stateless, like there's nothing that's going to get carried over between requests. One way would be like if you did have a small amount of state, is it common to see people say, well, yeah, but I just have this one little thing I need to pull, and maybe that's persistent in a database or some other backend thing, and then they just pull from that every time the function triggers. Is that a common pattern, or is that like frowned upon?
Persistent database is absolutely a common thing, right? So like you can see SQL, you can see CosmosDB. CosmosDB actually is used a lot with other Azure Functions, or like you can even use storage and stuff like that. Obviously you can persist state elsewhere, but just like if you had like a static counter in your logic tier, like that does not go to functions. Like the same way, like you can talk about 12-factor app and you know microservices being stateless, but here it's like truly enforced. You really can't pass anything between function execution.
And if I recall correctly, Sasha, I know we're talking about serverless, but obviously at the end of the day, Azure is the one that's kind of provisioning a server for you, right, dynamically under the covers. Obviously, there is a server involved. It's just that the user or the developer doesn't really care about it. They get a server for them. And I believe, consequently, it's a little more expensive to run a piece of code in functions as opposed to, say, running it somewhere else, right?
No. So actually functions are very, very cheap. They're like, I mean, cents for like, I would say if you had like a million executions, you'd probably pay like $2. It is something like that. Like I'm obviously, you can look up the pricing, but they're really.
No, what I meant is that if you, you know, if you do the same amount of work on using Azure Functions and, and you know, like a long running transaction, like you gave an example, right? And that same long running, if I ran it using Azure, another Azure service, it would be more expensive in functions, I believe, because they kind of almost what they almost reserving some hardware for you, right? Some server for you.
Yeah. So okay, I see what you mean. So if you wanted to run a function continuously, so functions have two different deployment modes, which is actually a really cool thing because it solves some of the issues that typically dynamic allocation has, right? Because dynamic allocation, for instance, has like a little bit of a cold start issue. If you deploy functions to up service, you don't have that issue. So if you have the consumption plan, which allows you to dynamically scale, or you have the app service plan, which allows you to run sort of continuously, right? So you have at least one VM instance backing you up. Now, if you're running a continuous function, like something that performs all the time, the running an app service will actually be cheaper than running consumption plan. That is absolutely true.
Well, it's like everything else. I mean, you're for the ability to kind of do this when you need this massive scale, you have no idea when it's coming in, right? So you don't want to pay when it's not coming in, but you do need to when it comes in scale. You're paying a little bit of a premium for that,
right?
Opportunity, I guess maybe is the right, maybe not quite the right word, but the ability to do that versus if you say, hey, I'm willing to pay a little bit. I want to pay a little bit less. But I kind of always have to have this stuff running. We're kind of giving you the benefit of saying, hey, we know you're going to keep paying us over time, right? And you're always going to pay us this small amount. Versus the other way, you may pay nothing at all, but then you spike, right? You pay everything, and then you're done, right? So it's like an opportunity cost in essence.
Yeah, it's an opportunity cost, and it's also the economy of scale. Mm-hmm. So it's like the same way, you know, the reason that serverless makes sense in the cloud and it never made sense before and it was never invented before is because if you were trying to do this on your own infrastructure, you would essentially have a lot of standby infrastructure just waiting to execute these small pieces of code, and that made no sense for pretty much any organization. Mm-hmm. But since we're operating on this massive scale where, hey, I provisioned a function and essentially you are promising me that whenever I need to scale, you will give me the infrastructure, but you know that there's a million other people that are running on the same infrastructure, so you're always like you always have that backup of someone's going to use your services and make this financially justified.
Right. Yeah. So where does this leave us with regard to this new event grid stuff that I heard about a couple of weeks ago, Sasha?
Yeah. So event grid is really, I think it was released like a month ago, and something like that. And it's still in preview, so it's only available in a couple of regions. But the idea with that is it's treating events as a first-class citizen. So essentially, it allows you to publish and subscribe any kind of events and react to them. So it's kind of a built-in thing. If you think about, I think the idea that this came from is that, hey, I want to subscribe and know and take an action whenever, say, someone, I don't know, shuts down a VM, right? So it was possible to react to events like this with Azure, but it was kind of complicated. Now you can just subscribe to an event. You can create a topic for that particular event. You can create a filter for, you know, to filter out, say, it's a shutdown versus startup or whatever. And you can subscribe to that from different subscribers, and you can take action. So you can subscribe from Function App, you can subscribe from a Logic App, or you can subscribe from a third-party service and do something completely different. And in the same way, you can publish events from different publishers. So the topics can be custom, and you can push the events from, say, AWS to Azure and react to them in Azure.
That sounds very good. Almost like is that like the next evolution of functions, or how is that positioned?
Thing. Yes, it's definitely a complementary thing. It's so for instance, if I wanted to trigger a function when an event in Azure happens, I had to like either look for a specific trigger that existed, or look for a say configure it in Logic App where there is a trigger for that, or like write some sort of custom code to be able to identify that something happened. Now I can say, hey, I'm subscribing to one of the examples that, for instance, they talked about in one of the Azure Channel 9 videos was, hey, I want to subscribe to any time anybody assigns a role on my subscription. Right? An event like this previously was really hard to identify and react to, but now you can create an event grid subscription to that particular event and then trigger your function or, again, a logic app that can trigger anything else. But again, if we're talking in conjunction with functions, you can trigger your custom code from that. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense. Thank you, Sasha. That definitely clears it up for me. Well, this has been really good, Sasha. I appreciate all the info you've been giving us on serverless computing. And I don't know, guys, any more questions for Sasha before we let her go?
No, this is great. It actually helps kind of frame it in the context. I especially like the fact that we're kind of back to our origin, right? It's newer and it's better, but what goes around comes around. So thank you for coming on.
Right. Yeah. And send us information about the book, and we'll definitely put that in the show notes as well, along with this podcast.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you guys. Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks again for coming on. Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.